I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 1958. The album, The Future Lies Ahead. The artist, Mort Saul. My guest, Vic Shati. Did I say it correctly? Please tell me you said it right.
You did it perfectly.
Yay.
Way to go.
Awesome. So, tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into talking about why you chose Mort Saul of all people.
Sure. My name is Vic Shati. I currently live in Houston, Texas. I have been obsessed with comedy since I was a little one. I was trying to remember my first record. I think the first record I actually listened to was Stan Freberg's United States of America Volume 1.
Wow.
Which, of course, a popular one for your show.
Yep.
And still one of the all-time greats. And the first record I ever bought was Patton Oswalt's Werewolves and Lollipops. Have you covered that one?
We have not, and I actually, about a month ago, was given that on vinyl, so I'm looking forward to hearing it on vinyl for the first time.
It counts. It's on vinyl.
Yep.
Yeah, I remember I saved my lunch money for a week. I got $3 every day, and on the Friday I snuck my way to the mall. I think I was 11, and I bought that album.
Oh, my God.
And they didn't card me. They should have.
Yeah. So you starved yourself for a week.
I did. I will always choose comedy over food, which is a good diet, frankly.
Oh, yeah. Got it.
I grew up, Mort Saul. I discovered him through my comedy hero, Jon Stewart. I grew up with that voice in my house since I was, since the show premiered in 99. I think my family started watching it in 2001. He cited him as an influence, Mort Saul. And so once I had the ability to have a car and take me to all those weird record stores you can't get to when you're young, I found this one. I found The Future Lies Ahead, and I had Look Forward in Anger. I got those when I was, a freshman in college.
Yeah. So
and,
let's, yeah. Sorry, yeah. Go ahead.
No, I mean, they have been, they introduced me to the world of comedy on vinyl. That is what I thought a stand-up record was for the past. And as soon as I learned more about other records, I learned how rare Mort is as a comedian. He is unique still.
Incredibly so. And I mean, doing the exact same thing, which is insane to me. Like it's. I mean, you pointed out right before we were doing this that it does say on the back, Mort's material is not written.
It's not written. I love that they want you to know that he is flying by the seat of his pants and he decided to record it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is the era that was inventing improv as an art form, but to do it as a stand-up, not that that was impossible at the time, but as prolific as he was, I think that's maybe the most impressive part, having done so many albums.
Yeah, I mean, the Compass Players gets the credit for creating improv. Chicago gets that credit.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have to do the timetable here, because what Mort is doing is improv by himself. This is what a solo improv show would be. He plays the character of an uninformed man, even when he was, a 28-year-old boy. He's 30 when he records this album, so he is still, he's very young. And it's crazy to think that he is one of the founders of improv that doesn't get the credit. And improv is my love outside of, I try to write plays as well, but improv is what gets me on a stage.
Yeah.
I love improv, so Mort is a godfather there.
Have you done stand-up? That was a slash in there.
I'm open micer here in Houston. We have a lot of great Houston comics. I've done a couple open mics, but it's tough. It's tough because you are, as Mort shows, you're flying by the seat of your pants, and you have to make that fun for yourself, or improv where you can get stimuli from other people. You have to build the fun in a stand-up set.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That is, and it's a
that's
thing
tough.
That I've never
tough.
Had the guts to do it ever. But it's something you still continue to try.
Yeah, I go up when I can. The truth is, when you're an open micer and nobody knows you for stand-up, you're waiting for, 5 hours to get on stage sometimes.
Right.
And that's rough. That's rough. I treat my YouTube videos and my podcasting empire, I'm just kidding, as my creative outlet for, thoughts that stand-up could hold.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like, Mort might be the first podcaster, and he didn't even know it.
Right.
And I think the stand-up medium really does translate to the iPhone surprisingly well.
Sure.
So Yeah, that's. I think I put my more poor. I put more of my love there. But stand-up is the art form that I respect the most. I wrote a play entirely about stand-ups when I was a freshman in college. And there's the mystery there that no other art form has. The kind of traveling, vagabond aspect of it is, it's magical.
What's funny is I'm fascinated listening to people talk about stand-up, but again, having never done it, I still don't necessarily desire to do it, which is a good thing, because honestly, you don't need
more
stand-up.
And why is that for you? Why is that?
I don't know. I love sketch. I love improv on camera, sometimes on stage. But yeah, I don't know. It's stand-up is a thing that does not feel approachable for. I've written plenty of jokes that I think would be great as stand-up bits, but I'm like, I don't have a thing. If I got up there, I'd be reading, and I would not want to take the time to develop it into an act. I think that could be laziness.
Don't you feel guilty though? I feel a sense of guilt because I feel like stand-up is what people think comedians are.
Yeah, that is true.
In the broadest strokes terms, and I don't know. I like. It's the purest form of comedy in a real way, because it is, I had this idea at home, I thought of it, I thought through it, I wrote through it, I talked through it, here it is for you. Every other form has some form of collaboration. Stand-up is the dictatorship, you know?
Right, absolutely. And I mean, as a result, the strongest voices are going to come out, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that could be me pulling something out of my ass, but it does seem like, a result of that, I think the strongest, at least in terms of incredibly, just strongest in general, but opinionated is one, and I would definitely put Mort Saul in that category, although he's so... Let's talk a bit about him. Like, I don't know what it is. He's opinionated. He's got his views, but he's so incredibly, at least on The Future Lies Ahead, very casual about the things he's saying. He doesn't seem to be angry. I was just looking at the title. Look for it in anger. Anger. But yeah, you know, he's not an angry guy. Seemingly, he's not. You know.
Yeah, he's in conversation with the crowd, which is. It's some advanced acting, if ever I've heard it. He doesn't seem angry, but the more informed you get, I think you have to take sides on this kind of stuff.
Sure, yeah.
And Mort, I have a great quote from Mort that I pulled from. I listened to in preparation for this because I didn't want to be stranded in the water talking to you, Jason.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to as many Mort records I get my hand on. I got my hands on six in the time we had.
Wow, all right.
But here is a line I pulled that I don't think he knew that he would be this kind of guy when he started out. In Mort Saul's America from 1997, he says, "Any fool can say what he thinks. An audience demands you know what you think before you speak so you can start to arrive at what you truly care about." So I think in 1958, Future Lies Ahead, Mort Saul iconoclast, he's talking about everything here, but he's finding what really rankles him and what makes him angry. So I would agree with you. I don't think he's angry here yet, but he is discovering what gets him mad enough to rant, I suppose.
That's interesting. Yeah, you know, that's a very good point. And I'm glad you listened to six of them because I did not have the opportunity. So you are going to be the one schooling me for sure. What about Mort Saul appeal? So how old are you when you first hear Mort Saul again?
I think I was 18.
All right. That's a good age.
Yeah. It's the ripe age, because I think he in this album specifically, he's talking to what he calls the college people. And he's like, he feels a little guilty for appealing to young people. Did you catch this? It's almost like, don't tell your parents, but here's a joke for you, you youngins.
Mm-hmm. Right.
For the intellectuals in the crowd, here's a good one. I think I'm the target demographic for what he was going for. And it really did sing to me as far as what stand-up could be.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, I guess, when did you get introduced to stand-up, Jason?
Ooh, boy. I mean, I can't even name the time. I mean, it would have been probably not till I moved back to the U.S. from Germany, because I don't think I could have been exposed to stand-up before then at all. And
is there German stand-up? I have to believe there is.
There has to be. I will tell you, I have some stand-up records from other countries that I cannot yet translate, because I can't. There's got to be German. I've got to ask my German friends. Uh-oh. Actually, it's never been a question that I've asked them before.
That's awesome. You've got to translate some comedy.
Yeah, right. That would be amazing. I've got some that's Norwegian. I do, and I have an Israeli sketch group. I've got like three of their albums. I want to know what the hell they're talking about. That stuff. But yeah, I think probably not until I was a little kid, and my mom would probably put on Caroline's Comedy Hour or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I always, if it was goofy enough and I got the jokes, I was good to go. But it's because it was kind of this background thing. I've talked about this before on the podcast. Stand-up didn't, I guess I forgot it was a thing until, I started mm-hmm. the podcast back up, oddly, until I started the podcast up. Yeah, it just didn't occur to me as a thing people did.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly grew up when I was young, and the stand-up that was new coming out was... I think it's fair to say a weak era. I'm thinking of like 2005, 2007. This is when Dane Cook and Carlos Mencia are the stand-ups that my friends had heard of. Right. Larry the Cable Guy and the Blue Collar Comedy Boys. No disrespect.
Sure.
But it was just a different kind of comedy. I think the performance was more valued than the writing. And of course, I think of myself as a writer first, and that is what tickles me. So I had to go and find these things. And so Jon Stewart was my roadmap, but he brought me to George Carlin, and mm-hmm. he brought me to Woody Allen, and he brought me to, of course, I grew up on Seinfeld, but Seinfeld was in reruns by that
sure.
point. My friends didn't watch Seinfeld, and I felt like the cool kid who did. of course... it wasn't that far from where we get the Louis Renaissance and all the great stuff that would come up with the internet being accessible and popularized. I had to kind of find it. And it was kind of like you felt a joy in the quest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Finding good comedy.
Good comedy. Right. And what was your outlet? Pardon me. What was where were you finding it?
Well, it started at my at the Barnes & Noble. They had a tiny comedy section that nobody ever visited in like their CD department. And sure. so these albums would always be really cheap.
Awesome.
And so it became a thing where like, okay, you get $15 a week with the lunch money. You can buy like two Rodney albums or a Sam Kinison for $5 each.
That's awesome. Okay.
And that is so I started hoarding these things. And as soon as I was able to drive, I discovered, resale shops and like antique stores. And that is where you could find some really under the radar people. My rule for a while is if I could afford it, I would pick up any comedy album if I hadn't heard of the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was more excited by someone I didn't know
sure.
than a great album by a great. So I have a comedy collection full of like. God help you. I can't even, I'm trying to think of some names off the top of my head, but yeah. I'm sure you would probably know them.
Possibly. But, I got to tell you, man, there's some really obscure ones that still kind of blow my mind.
I'll pull up my collection and I'll spout out.
Oh my God, that will be fun. there's something I want to get to the core of, which is, and I have to be completely honest, I like Mort Saul's style. He's obviously a good comedian. He's obviously pulling laughs, but I'm going to completely admit my age and what goes over my head, and that's plenty of it in terms of the
sure.
actual stuff that's happening at the time, because we should at least tell people what he does is he hops up on stage with a friggin' newspaper and just goes to town. That's what
yeah.
he does.
And tell me your thought on this, because I was thinking back through this. Yes, that is his thing. Is he's not using the newspaper, though. That is a prop.
Just as a prop,
because,
right.
Yeah, because he's not reading it.
Right.
That would be a misconception to say he
sure.
is like going up there and like doing a free association in front of the audience.
Right.
He's got things to talk about.
Yes, he's like it is a perfect symbol, though, of how incredibly kind of the opposite of timeless they are in terms of content. Like, not to say that these are not universal concepts he's talking about. He's predating the anger that's going to come with Nixon very well. He's preparing people for Nixon, I feel like. he sees shit for what it is very much. I don't want to say tells it like it is, because I hate when people say tells it like it is.
It's overused.
It really isn't upsetting. It's
we
very
have
upsetting.
President tells you like it is. We don't need that.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's something about that where this idea of hopping up there and talking about what's happening of the day that is risky. In terms of like, will this play? And also, I don't know that he cares if it plays or not later on. Like, he's just, he made so many albums. Maybe it wasn't an issue.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie to you and say I understand every reference here. Sure. It's impossible unless you know the intricate histories of, at this point, you know, Eisenhower America.
Yes, right.
Ironically, I think in the moment, the specifics were the candy because you have somebody finally talking about the world you live in.
Definitely.
But now, ironically, for modern audiences, you have to listen to more for style over substance,
yes.
I think.
Yes. Yeah.
His lens for stand-up is the unique part. The way he does it, the how, is the thing we can learn from, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the thing where I found myself a bit, because I'm trying to remember, I heard The Future Lies Ahead for the first time, well, whenever the hell I bought it, which was before I did this podcast. It was when I thought I was going to start a vinyl comedy collection and wasn't quite ready because I was poor. But I did get this one. I remember being at first a little, lies, not bored at all. I think it was 100% his style that drew me in, because I remembered really liking it, thinking, oh, this guy's angry. I thought he was angry at the time. I look back and I'm like, that's not anger. Not compared to a lot of things, not compared to later Mort Saul. Mm-hmm. But there's something that attracted me to him. But I can't think right now what it was specifically. And I'm wondering, what about his style is so attractive to you?
I'll tell you that through a little bit of a story.
Sure.
When I got to college, I was really interested in sharing my comedy aficionado-ness with my friends, and as I'm sure you are when you discover like something great
sure.
that you don't think your friends know. So I went to the University of Houston, and I went through a friend of mine. He had just started like an internet radio station.
Hey,
he was desperately looking for slots to fill, and so I became the comedy guy there. I got like 4 hours every Saturday to play whatever I could and then talk through the rest. I just had to fill the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I played tons of stuff. I played Stan Freberg and the Smothers Brothers and Stiller and Mara and all these different records I had. But the one I got the most feedback from was when I played Mort Saul records, because they thought it sounded like talk radio of the day.
Okay.
I was surprised, honestly, that was the one that connected so much, but that one did. I think people kind of saw the same thing as far as what he's speaking. If you replace the pronouns of Mort Saul, this is modern material, I'd argue.
Okay, yeah.
And so he is timeless in a way that's incredibly timely, which is obviously super hard to do and something that great comedians probably do without you even noticing it.
Sure. So, yeah. Now, yeah. How many people are you playing this stuff for at the time? Like, are you gathering a lot of friends, or is it just like a, hey buddy, check this out? Like, what's the situation? I'm curious. Is this like a one by one? Did you gather people around?
It's certainly small at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Because there's no marketing behind an internet radio show, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So people talk, and truly word of mouth did spread.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the theater department, so I got everybody there to finally listen to the show. And it was really cool because these are actors and other creatives, but they're not comedians or stand-ups or anything focused on this specific career path. And they could find different things about it that connected. So ultimately on the show, which is called Hail Satire, which is the name of my podcast now, I started doing like comedy interviews, and that brought more people in. And but I still look back on those days fondly when you can just be like the actual comedy DJ and share this stuff with other people. But I think, yeah, I think Mort connected on a way that, you know, Steve Allen said that he is intentionally amateurish. Like,
yeah.
The lack of polish is what makes him relatable and, you know, that overused word real.
Yeah.
Like, he is intentionally unshowbusy, and that is really attractive.
Yeah.
And that's something that's become way more in vogue now. I think a big part of Louis C.K.'s appeal is he is an everyman, and he is seemingly outside of the system that so many comedians fall into and star in big movies and all that. That is still appealing, you know, 60 years later.
Mort's even, I mean, not that this is 100% rare, but Mort's, if something's funny, he'll laugh. He does seem to have that about him where, you know, yep. It's very much come along on this journey with me. Mm-hmm. What is
and,
there?
And the laughter, I wrote this down in my notes, but the laughter is like a form of agreement for him. Like, he'll hear a laugh and he go, yeah, I know, right? Like, he's just bringing a bunch of entrees to the table, and you try that one with a laugh, and he's like, isn't that good? It's a creme brulee or whatever. So it's like, quite literally, truth is comedy. That the comedy comes from, this is true enough to make you laugh.
Now, I'm curious, for yourself as a comedian, is it only a style influence? Is there an influence of... I don't know if we could... he's clearly trying to affect perception. I mean, most comics are, but in a very specific way, very political way, social way. Is there any of that in your comedy? Do you believe in that as an ethos in terms of doing your comedy? What's your perspective? Do you have a similar perspective to him in that way?
It flatters myself to even, you know, think I'm trying to do the same thing.
Sure.
But absolutely. I think it's a Mel Brooks quote. I think it's a Jon Stewart quote. I think it's a Mort Saul quote. Comedy is when you speak truth to power, and comedy is a vital tool that lay people have to strike up. Absolutely, the content of what he's talking about is important to his era, and he continues this his entire life. He still does, you know, these hour-long chats today in 2017. I think he's 90 years old,
uh-huh.
And he's still just finding ways to, you know, he interprets the news and then spits it out back at you with a little bit of italics attached.
Yeah.
I think the best thing a comedian can do is attempt to at least inform you, but also maybe convince you. I see nothing wrong with comedy that has an agenda to it.
That's awesome. I love hearing that, because there's it's so often, obviously all opinions are valid, but there's very much the, well, you know, if they're not laughing, then you're not doing your job. I don't particularly agree. I think sometimes if you expect something from your audience, a little bit of, maybe not participation, but if you expect some awareness of your audience, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. Can I share with you a little something I was privy to recently?
Sure.
I had the pleasure of interviewing a comic legend recently, Mr. Dick Gregory.
Awesome.
I talked to Dick Gregory, and he had the opposite opinion of you and I.
Really?
He gave me a couple quotes here. This is an article I wrote for my local paper called the Houston Press. But he said to me, I would never disrespect a human being enough to decide we can change something through comedy.
Wow.
In all of America's wars, they've never sent an entertainer to the front line. Who you've ever heard of being liberated by some jokes? I was shocked by that, because here, you know, a different man, but another man who was obviously informed by what Mort Saul had done in the 50s to produce some stuff in the 60s. And their comedy is about change. Their comedy is about the hope of improvement through language.
Sure.
So it's so interesting to hear him say that, and I respect his opinion if that's really what he believes, but I have to disagree.
Of course.
I do think comedy can move the needle in some way. I have to, you know, I grew up on Jon Stewart, and that absolutely formed what I feel, you know, 10 years later. It comedy can do that. It's the power of corrective laughter can move you towards perhaps more progressive ideals.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking of it, you know, in exactly what you're saying recently. I decided to put a little bit more thought into it because I was contacted by somebody who's doing research on something completely unrelated to comedy. But long story short, the way he wants to teach people about his field of work is by trying to understand comedy as an outsider. And I don't know why he picked comedy, but great. And he was pointed to me as somebody who can help him. And I think that's wonderful. But I think maybe there's a misperception of the power of comedy. I think we all understand that there is no direct connection between you, Vic, getting up on stage, making a joke, and tomorrow a war ending. Or this, it's no direct connection. It's such, it is such a slow, sometimes fast, depending on your level of power, but it's a slow whittling down and a slow, you know, there's enlightenment is part of it, but also just simply getting people to think your way or in a logical way. It's very
yeah.
I mean, there's no one way to do it, of course, but it's I don't know. I think that maybe that's it. Maybe people think that you're trying to say there's this direct connection between these two ideas, and you know.
And of course not. You know, often comedy does not go to the policymakers, but comedy goes to everybody else.
Yeah.
And you can change internal. It's like any good story. Any good movie can make you emote and feel something for a character and perhaps make you reflect on things you've done or you opinions you hold, beliefs you think are right. And you can change yourself through the catharsis of seeing someone else. So a joke is, I think, a little more streamlined. It's also a little more blunt object. It's a little more direct.
Sure.
Because you're not seeing it through, oh, look at their life. Is mine similar? This is often, here is an opinion or a thought, or you're playing with, you know, the inverse of something. And you have to decide... Because laughter is involuntary. If you hear other people laughing that connects with them on an intellectual level, you might laugh through automated response.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you think about these things in hindsight, why was that joke funny? Why did that get me in such a way or not get me? And I felt inclined to laugh because everyone around me was. And you can it can open up the same internal dialogue with yourself that any great film can.
That's perfect. And too often the effect of media or that's the only word I can use right now, but the art, the effect of art is usually explored in terms of the negative effect it can have specifically. I mean, the thing that stood out to me most when I was always questioning the power of art, and I mean, I was in college around the time of 9/11. So everybody, including comedians, was like, oh, can we still do comedy? This and this and this and this and this.
Yeah.
Yes, of course you can. And I was a young upstart 20-year-old. So I was like, of course you got to fucking make jokes. I was just so angry about it. And then I went to film school and took a film history class. And when it was revealed to me that because of the awful yet beautiful film Birth of a Nation, that the Ku Klux Klan found a resurgence, I was like, well, if that horrible thing can happen, maybe we can do some very good positive things. We'd have to try a little harder because I don't think it's hard to convince a racist to be more racist. But, you know,
or to sell fear.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. But I think if you got people willing to do the groundwork, which is to try and at the very least get people who are a little racist to be less racist, maybe if we work even harder, we can counteract the worst parts of what art can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm a big believer in, you know, the comedian is one of the few public roles that gets to be a philosopher as well.
Yeah,
like you get to simply talk through, why do we feel this way? Why do we jump on this thing and not on the other thing? Why are these acceptable forms of whatever and these not? I think you can draw a pretty strict line between Mort and every comedian working today, not just because this is the first comedy album ever, which I don't know if you've said yet.
Right.
This is history's first comedy album. Maybe only debatably between this and another Mort Saul record, On Sunset, which is a bootleg that was released after Future Lies Ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know which one's the first, but this one came out first, 58. And so the comedian gets to simply talk through their own thought process. So in a way that you, the audience, doesn't get in your daily life. I think that's why people love to do podcasts. It's an opportunity to share your own inner thoughts with another. And, it's why conversation has existed through the eons.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, we're in a position now to take in so many more conversations that we're just not going to be privy to because we've convinced ourselves we're too busy. And I guess podcasts are important in that way. I won't presume mine is, but, you know.
No, I mean, your podcast has, you know, when you get access to a brilliant mind, and you just get to pick it for a little bit.
Sure.
The stuff that falls out, of course, is good for you, the host.
Uh-huh.
But I think we forget the kind of residual effect that has on the listener. It absolutely, like, you know, whenever I'm trying to think of a play, I will go listen to a bunch of either news stories or just conversations, and things will trickle out.
Sure.
And I'll be like, that's a great story. There's a story in this truth. that can make a, you know, great film or a play or whatever. Mm-hmm. It really, you know, that's why podcasting is fun, is you get to talk with people that are smarter than you.
Absolutely. That's my favorite part. That's a funny thing too, is early on when people would, chide me for saying that, if somebody asked me a question about a comedian or an album, saying I don't know, and I was like, well, that's the point of this show, is I don't know and I'm trying to learn. I mean, I know plenty, but not nearly enough, and I never will, which is fun. Is there anything, again, we're talking more about style here, but is there anything on, are there any jokes on any of the Mort Saul albums you listen to that stand out as, well, that's a solid joke on its own?
Sure. I didn't write down anything besides from Future Lies Ahead. Mm-hmm. I was trying to focus on this one because it is the first one, but it's also a good comedy record. A couple of the jokes I liked, again, these belong in 58, but they still have, they're tightly worded. A joke I liked was, conservative Republicans don't believe anything should be done for the first time. Modern Republicans say it should be, but not now.
That's fucking great.
And of course, that happens before, you know, the South Democrat. The history of it actually gets in the way of me totally enjoying it. But it's like, I guess Republicans are still Republicans in 58. I kind of thought it switched over sooner, but who knows?
Right. Yeah. No. I know. That's kind of my perspective on it too. I think we are, since we're so post Newt Gingrich, it does sort of change the perspective on what a conservative Republican means too. It's such even that in and of itself has changed entirely, not entirely, but in some very critical ways. That's really funny. That's some good stuff.
Another good joke I have here is, Mort's having a conversation with his father, an imagined conversation. Mort says, I type on a Swiss typewriter. I bought it because I didn't want to buy a German or Italian typewriter because I remember. My dad questions this. Don't you remember that the money is in Swiss banks?
That's a nice double hit. I like that.
Yeah, it gets you both time. Yeah, it's interesting because, as we pointed out, Mort Saul's material is not written intentionally, as part of his, you know, his comic choice is to be present. So jokes, of course, require specifics. The joy of a joke is the tightness of it, of the intentionality of everything. So, like a good, you know, I make the argument that Mort's maybe one of the first kinds of stand-up, but he's also like the first of a new kind of newsman. Yeah, I think you can draw a straight line between him and the Young Turks and Rachel Maddow show, what Fox News has made into an empire, and of course, like, people on the internet like Alex Jones and all these nightmare people. the realness is valued above the fact. Now, we had the gift here with Mort Saul that he's informed as well as real, but I think now the style has overcome the substance. We take joy in the idea that this person is kind of off the cuff.
Mm-hmm.
Bill O'Reilly is speaking to you, the viewer. Keith Olbermann is speaking to you without a script. No need for poetics.
Right.
So it's very interesting to see him in the history of newsmen as well. Because he even mentions on this record he is so happy because he has 2 days a week on NBC's, is it radio? I think it's radio, right?
I think so, yeah.
It's NBC's Nightline on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like making a big deal about how it's not edited. They're not going to censor me in real time. And I'm like, if only, you know, obviously Mort's still around. He's seeing what's happening now.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is. That's a very good point. There's something to this, to the energy, obviously, of live performance alone, but the energy of improv, the energy of knowing it's entirely off the cuff. And at the same time, that he's dealing with something that is real of your world, something you might know something about or heard something about.
Yeah.
And the just having a perspective is enough because it's, I mean, I don't know, maybe I didn't analyze it close enough. In The Future Lies Ahead, not knowing him personally, would you put his personality, is there a character you could define him as in this? I think you mentioned something at the very beginning, but is there a way you could define his character on this album?
It's like, I would think of him as like the young college professor.
Uh-huh,
like
okay.
The one, you know, it's the guy from the liberal arts college that is still young enough to just be learning this stuff for the first time, but also has this air of authority that is trying to point you in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of like comedy's Indiana Jones or something. Like he is the fun class. I would take him without getting course credit.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's amazing. I like it. Now, can you hear over the course? I mean, the Mort Sahl's America is as far mm-hmm. away as 1997.
Yeah.
What's the character there?
It's unfair to compare them because mm-hmm. 97, it's a two disc album, I think.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The first half is he's sitting. It's I guess it still is Mort Sahl doing stand up, but mm-hmm. it's really in dialogue with the audience. It's
okay.
Like he's waiting for responses. The pauses are everywhere. Now, maybe this is because in the record form, it's so short. You know, the first record on Sunset, they had to speed it up because there was too much material for one LP.
Wow.
With the CD, he's got more time. And then the second half, the second disc of Mort Sahl's America, it's him in conversation with a senator, a very funny senator. I think his name is Joseph McCarthy, but it's not.
Interesting.
Maybe it's McCartney.
Okay.
Maybe it's McCartney. Because I was like, oh my God, they got him.
Right.
And it's not him. He's a liberal Democrat with a great sense of humor. He's got some of the better lines on the album. But those later ones, he really does kind of run a very early form of the TED Talk.
Interesting. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Wow.
Here, this is recognizable as stand up to me. If I heard this on the radio, not knowing when and not knowing who, this is still comfortably stand-up, where I feel like 97 is closer to a Q&A with very few cues.
I like that. Have you had the opportunity to meet him ever? I don't know where. I'm assuming he only performs where he lives, but.
Yeah. No. I've had a couple run-ins with. So on my show, Hail Satire, I've talked to over 160 people. A lot of comedians and writers and directors and awesome people. In fact, we both talked to Rachel Bloom.
Oh, yeah.
That's how I discovered your show. It's like, I love Rachel. I'm going to bone up on her before I talk to her.
Yeah.
And then I found your show.
Oh, awesome.
Also, one of my improv classmates, Jack Dolgen, was on
oh,
your show. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
amazing. I love him. Great guest.
Great guy. What were we talking about? No, I've never met Mort. I've written to his manager a couple of times, and one time I think they were charmed by the fact that I was a college student. I was like, you know, I don't know, I was 20 when I wrote them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, oh, yeah, I mean, Mort's all about the college audience. Please, let's set something up. And I said, okay, whenever. I'll cut class, whatever it takes.
Yeah.
And then it was radio silence forever. And I've written them a couple more times. I still mm-hmm. hold out hope that maybe I could. There's a Mount Rushmore of people I'd like to talk to, and Mort is, he's Lincoln,
yeah.
you know. He is... And he's still the thing. It's he's still there at 90. I watched him on Periscope. I don't know, a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And this is he still sounds like him. He's still as quick. I mean, just physically, his like voice still travels at the same pace, which just doesn't happen.
That's impressive.
When you're older. And of course, he's still sharp and engaged. He, you know, he had a lot of thoughts on Trump, a lot of thoughts on Hillary.
Yeah.
Which is just fascinating. So I feel like, you know. He released 7 albums in a span of 4 years, which, of course, is amazing for a comic
mm-hmm.
and very, very slow for a journalist. But then there's this drought, you know? You don't have him again till 73 and then 97.
Yeah.
And then I think that's the last one.
Yeah.
You know, I wish people would just record everything and put it out there. I'll pay the 99 cents or whatever, you know. I just want to hear you. Where
yeah.
are you?
He's a guy who, I mean, not that he necessarily needs to, but I feel like we as a comedy loving community would benefit from having whatever the hell he does available, you know, and it'd be fantastic to listen to. At least you could pick and choose all you want, but yeah, it would be great.
I mean, I really wish there was some kind of it doesn't need to be polished, doesn't need to be, you know, oh, he's on HBO or Comedy Central. Like, it just every 5 years or so, give me what Mort's doing. Give a show that's already been recorded and put it to your people, because, you know, wouldn't you like to know what he has to say about every historical marker?
Right.
The last one he really does is Watergate. Like,
yeah.
he comes out, you know, record retirement for Watergate. And of course, that's big, but we've had big since.
Yeah, right. And the other thing there is, I just had to read an article about this, about all the Nixon comedy albums. I mean, that's coming out late mm-hmm. for a Nixon comedy album. That's the first Nixon comedy album, was like 69 or so. It would have
yeah.
had to have been. And so, like, that's, it's just weird to be that I mean, to be fair, there's way more to say once Watergate hits. These other ones were warning you against Nixon. But yeah, it's weird for that to be. But again, he must absolutely just love being on stage. I mean, that old and still doing it, that's impressive.
And of course, I think in the biography of Mort Saul, you can, you know, it's clear that, so he had the ear of JFK, he had the ear of LBJ, and he had the ear of Nixon. He, you know, in the Watergate album, he's talking about being on a plane with Nixon, and he tells a great little story there. I think he is very much thrown off the tracks by the Warren Commission, and when Kennedy's assassinated, that gives his life and his comedy and what he wants to spend his time on new purpose. So it's I don't know, but it's possible that he has gone from the mic intentionally. He's not doing shows. He's focused on other things, and you know, maybe he's been a little bit of a detective. So I think that is part of why he goes from having, you know, an album every 6 months to not one for 5 years or so. But still, you know, that has, we've since moved on from that, and there are new atrocities to investigate.
Boy, oh boy. Is there anyone out there that you like that reminds you of Mort Saul? Are you looking for anybody? Is it a thing that you would like to see more of, or are you fine with it just being the realm of Mort Saul?
So I think we see his influence everywhere. As I see it in the news, I see it, but I don't see it as much in stand-up, actually. I feel like if I were to put my eggs in the stand-up basket and say, this is what I'm spending all my time on, forget podcasts, forget, you know, improv, forget interviews, like, this is where I'm going, I would think I would try to emulate this style, because I feel like it's been so long, it's almost novel again.
Yeah.
This kind of truly, you have me for 45 minutes, I'm on stage, let's chat. What, you know, shout out what you're interested in. Sure. If you can get fast enough to have both jokes and hot takes, that would be something we haven't seen, you know, even in this Netflix buffet line of comedy coming out every 5 minutes.
So, yes.
And then also I really, I do believe that the way we consume media has changed. Obviously this is no revelation, but like what podcasts can do to let you have the intimacy of a stand-up, an hour with somebody on a more frequent basis. You're talking to someone for an hour every week or so. That is the new form of stand-up. That really kind of, you're in the home with the person. And so I think a good, you know, look at like Bill Burr's show, Bill Burr's morning podcast. It's not far. It's, you know, or even like the intros to all the WTFs when Marin is just kind of rambling. Yeah. Like that ramble is valuable. Some people skip through these things, but that's what I'm usually there for. Like, how you doing, Mark? How you doing, Jason? How you doing is kind of what Mort is really good at here.
Yeah.
And he kind of dresses himself in the big issues because he is a high-minded man with a lot to think about. But, you know, the comfortability of this improv thing is not to go understated. He is present and is as interested as the audience is in these topics, you know?
Sure. Yeah, no, that's a very good point. I mean, everything you're saying is almost giving me a panic attack, and that's only because it's making me put myself in the place of, what the fuck would I do if I obviously wouldn't be that guy, but what would I do if I were that guy? If I put on myself the responsibility of being the next Mort Saul. Let's say I had that level of social political intelligence, which I don't. I have an awareness. I have an intelligence that I think is better used elsewhere, like examining comedy albums. But so let's say it's you. What would be the hardest part of it for you? What would be the easiest part of it for you?
The hardest part is the part that Mort is best at. He's, you know, I don't know his level of information on any specific topic, but that never shows. The man is informed, and I don't feel like he is part of the fake news propaganda.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
So I think it has to be, you know, it'd be so easy to, it's easy to conflate your opinions with the information. And of course, comedy needs opinion.
Sure.
So it's, I guess, being on the right side. Like Mort said, you have to know what you think before this even begins, so you can already give quick takes on new information.
Yeah.
of course, that can lead to, you know, the conspiracy theory.
Sure.
That can take you too far, and then you get Alex Jones, and of course, there's no credibility there because the man's nuts.
Right.
So I think definitely the hardest part is maintaining the personal integrity that Mort seems to have, and Jon Stewart had, and Stephen Colbert has, and John Oliver has, and Samantha Bee has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this current crop of satirists take information seriously. Mm-hmm. You know, in days gone by, it didn't matter what the truth was because you make your own truth in stand up. You know,
sure.
You can tell me the president fell off a moving train, and you know, a fraction of the audience is going to believe you for the joke.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so who is it? I think Samantha Bee says, I read The Daily Show Oral History recently, that great book by Chris Smith. When you're making comedy out of fantasy, it's like wringing a dry towel for jokes.
Yeah.
Like you, when you use the current paradigm, the current reality, you're already halfway there because everybody's got a little bit. So it's certainly that the hardest part has to be the, you're on the right side of this stuff, and you know what you're talking about enough to share your thoughts. What's the best part? What's the easiest part? As opposed to a Stephen Wright, who, you know, some of the greatest stand-ups of all time have got to have, you know, an 8-year overhead to get another album out because it's, you know, how many great jokes can you think of? You know, I look at, like, you know, Stephen Wright's a classic example, but Anthony Jeselnik has amazing jokes. Holy shit, he's got some amazing jokes. But there's just got to be, you can only make so much in so much time, where, you know, Bill Maher, as he says himself, he reads out of the newspaper. He literally does the Mort's all. My shit changes every day.
Yeah.
So the fun thing is, when I was growing up, I was a big fan of Calvin and Hobbes. And that was one of the things my dad gave me as a kid, of these books. And I was always taken with the idea that, so Bill Watterson, the writer, leaves after 10 years because he says he has no more ideas. Isn't that the most horrifying thing for a creative person? The idea of you could run out of ideas. And as I've gotten older, I'm still kind of like putting my hope in the idea that you can't run out of stuff to talk about, because, you know, life continues, you continue, all these things, there's always new stimuli.
Yeah.
But I was always shaken by that. Like, my God, what if you put your career in the, you know, the basket of, it could be only temporary. You only have so many great ideas, kid. So I have to believe that's not true. I have to believe that you will always have new inspiration. And so being, you know, a podcaster who gets to, you know, if you are in the position where people listen to you on the daily, that they're following not only the stories through your eyes, but your life, that's comforting, because, you know, people care enough, supposedly. And I think that's a big thing. You know, stand-ups are kind of like baseball players in that way. You can kind of collect the stand-up cards in the form of albums or whatever.
Sure.
You know, you're following, what was Louis C.K. doing in 2007 versus what is he doing in 2017? I care about him as a purveyor of comedy, but I also care about him as a human.
Mm-hmm.
And you follow his wins and his losses.
Yeah.
That's my thought. But of course, you know, the podcasting thing is, it really is different. I think it's another form of radio, but it's you pick when you listen. You can binge a thing. If I fall in love with the show, I will go, you know, and I'll do all of Serial season one in a day.
Yeah.
You know, or if you follow, you know, people follow them for sports. I'm a big fan of the show Survivor, so there's some Survivor podcasts out there that have constant coverage in that regard. And you get connected to the commentators.
Yeah.
And so you are having a little panic attack over there, but you absolutely are somebody people follow, and they share their love of comedy with you. And, you know, you do have, people follow the host as much as the guest, I think.
Yeah. That could be true. You're making me think of, again, one step further about this whole idea about, let's imagine you as the next Mort Saul. Let's just, again, this is a fun thing to imagine.
I am.
There,
of course.
Good. Well, then the next thing is responsibility. This is, do you have it? Do you not have it? Because I know that Jon Stewart went out of his way to say, I'm not a journalist. therefore he's effectively ridding himself of any responsibility, which half of me agrees with, and then half of me is like, if you do know your effect, I feel like you then do have a responsibility. What's your opinion in terms of, you know, let's say you start out as as the new Mort Saul, and then you end up the next Jon Stewart. Mm-hmm. What happens?
If you were starting at one and ended the other, those are both great lives to live.
Absolutely.
You know, I majored in playwriting in school, and one of the first things I wrote was a 10-minute play about Jon Stewart on Crossfire.
Awesome.
That little moment. Yeah. I wrote, like, it was the behind the scenes of what was happening during the commercial breaks, basically.
I love it.
And I decided to ignore John's insistence that he doesn't, he says he's not a journalist, but that doesn't mean he doesn't care.
Sure.
And I think that is the essential difference, because, you know, journalists care, comedians care. They can both care equally. It doesn't matter what you call them, I guess.
Yeah.
So if you are, you know, because John is always running back to the idea, like, look, the thing making, you know, my opening act is puppets making crank phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
I've restarted the Herculean effort of watching The Daily Show from the beginning with a friend, and we're doing a podcast on it.
Oh, wow.
And if you watch those 99 Daily Shows, you can see every moment of, this guy, whenever someone says, you know, you're the most trusted man in America, he can go back to the time he made a pig fart joke that lasted 6 minutes. Like, it's genuinely easy to have that story. But it's disingenuous to say that these guys are not making a difference. So what was the question? If you start at Mort Saul and you become Jon Stewart, what was
it? Yeah, just in general, what's your opinion about your responsibility as a comedian if you're always calling yourself a comedian?
So, like, I guess I'm in the minority, because I know there's comics you've had on your show that would crucify the idea of the laugh is not first.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to believe there are good laughs and there are bad laughs. And,
right.
you know, a funny guy, a drunk guy at a party can get laughs.
Sure.
A homeless person can get laughs. But this is not what the job of a comedian should be.
Yeah.
So I think it's okay to value certain material over others, and mm-hmm. that is the only way to find your voice. I believe. So
I
yeah, I think as responsibility goes, you have to, you know, you only have so much free bandwidth when you meet a new person. They're going to hear so much of you, and if it doesn't click, they're not really going to pursue you.
Yeah.
So you have to care enough about what you're talking about and give them something that is chewable. There's enough there that you can do a little bit of DIY comedy on their own.
Yeah.
If you bring interesting philosophical stuff to the table, that is just as good for me as an amazing laugh. I think philosophy has its place in stand-up, and that differentiates between the okay and the great.
Yeah.
So, and of course, you know, I'm very cognizant of the fake news thing now because it's so in the zeitgeist, but it's not only talking about issues, but it's being on the right side of those issues that can be dicey. And of course, I'm totally okay with when, you know, I always bring them up, but Louis C.K. is bringing up an incredibly egregious concept to shock you.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's trying to kind of wiggle you down the aisle to see it his way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I am not the PC police as far as, you know, what we should be talking about when we shouldn't. But I also don't, like, I don't prescribe to the ideology that this is killing comedy.
Sure. Yeah.
This you know, we can't be shackled to all the mores of, I can't be racist anymore. I can't be a bigot. Well, no, you can't.
Right.
If that's the only way you can laugh, get out of comedy, buddy.
I 100% agree.
Give me your intake.
You are 100% where I am. I have a problem with people thinking that political correctness is censorship rather than respect for other human beings. And political correctness can go too far, but I also don't think that it's political correctness at that point. And I would challenge any comedian who says they're being censored to go visit a country where the government actually censors you before you say that. I'm not censoring you. I'm saying you're allowed to say what you want to say, but you have to accept that there are consequences, like a grown person does. That's mm-hmm. what we all do. And also, whether or not you're doing a lazy joke. If you're doing a lazy joke, stop doing comedy or do better jokes. I mean, that's the next thing.
But there's also, you know, I do not bury my head in the sand and say that this happens in a vacuum.
Sure.
I think there is some blood in the water when there is one Twitter joke is pulled out of context for the hot new thing. And, oh, isn't it fun? Let's tear the new hotness down.
Absolutely. Yeah. So
I think it goes both ways. Sometimes it is overreaction. But again, you are responsible for what you put out there. So yep. If you can't own it. Now, I get times change. If you pull out a thing from, you know, 1995 right. and say this is the reason you can't have a job in 2017, well, fuck you. I mean, really,
that doesn't
make any sense. But if you were pulling stuff out from last year and saying this is what you think about, you know, the joke is not that, like, if the joke is just like at the expense of Mexicans or the transgender community, like anything, you have to be smart about that because, you know, what is worth it to you to be the guy who's being strung up right now?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I think it's true. You know, there is an element of the media likes to talk about stuff and they like to really kind of have the round table and decide, is this fair? Is this not fair? Chelsea Handler, what do you think?
Right.
Bill Maher, what do you think? Like, that's fun, but also because it gives us stuff to talk about, too. I'm not against it, you know. I did an entire podcast based around when the interview happened and like what is fair and what is not, you know,
sure.
who's the blame, who's at fault. You can't be the person that is unable to defend their thing. If you're just like, well, you want to crucify me, fine, go ahead, I'll take the bullets.
Right.
No, give me a reason.
Yeah. No, that's perfect. And it's also making me think. Just to hop back to this idea that the joke is king and the laugh is king and that the laugh comes first. The logical problem there is that a thought should be first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's simple enough. The joke or the laugh is never the first thing. The joke isn't the first thing. The joke is the second thing. And the laugh, one hopes, is the third thing. And this is where people, you can justify all the bad comedy you want. By saying that the laugh is first. But you know what? The only laugh that's first is if I fall down on my ass as an accident and then that person involuntarily laughs. Fine.
Yeah.
I won't call that an invalid laugh, but like, I'm not going to say that you just put a whole lot of thought into falling on your ass.
No. It's totally the thing of, you know, a great joke is a specific architectural design for a thought. You know, and if somebody takes apart the walls and undoes the carpet and looks at your hardwood flooring to see that you have a thing against a specific group or you believe you something that is not OK, that is something that you kind of as the comic have to reckon with. Where is my sense of humor coming from? Because we all have different stimuli to shape us. But you want to be helpful, doing something for the good of the world, because a person with a microphone has a power.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so, and if you assume that, yeah, I mean, why do you want laughs? If your reason for wanting laughs is only for your own ego, well, that's one thing. But I think a lot of us, at the very least, eventually put a little bit of purpose to that laugh because we're like, well, that strokes my ego, but let's maybe give this a little more purpose to it.
Yeah, and that's why I do respect the stand-up still, even as everything changes. There's like a certain element, and it's so hard, and it's so not worth it at a certain point that it gets rid of all these assholes that are just here to get the sitcom job.
Sure.
Like, it keeps it pure and like, look, if you're going to tell this, you know, dirty hookers joke a fucking million times, you better, you know, it better mean something at a certain level. You're putting your name on that in front of, you know, 50 people at a time or whatever.
Yeah.
So that like, I still have the ultimate reverie for stand-up because I think it's so absurdly hard. It's pointlessly, like, intentionally obtuse for the layperson that there's something beautiful about it.
Yeah. Ah, that's good. Yeah. Well, what I could talk to you for hours. This is way too much fun for me. But
at the same to you.
Thank you. I always like to ask people, why would you recommend? And I would say feel free to either recommend the album if you think that's a reason, or the career, the man. Give the audience a recommendation. If they don't know who the hell Mort Saul is, why give him a listen?
I'll definitely recommend the career of Mort Saul,
mm-hmm.
Because I think there's a real scarcity of Mort Saul material out there. You go on iTunes, you can get two of his, 11 albums or so.
Wow. Okay.
So this requires your participation to understand and hear the man. Even on YouTube, you can't find I wanted to be as informed as possible and listen to everything, but Amazon wouldn't get to me in time. To buy these things from, New Haven or something.
Yeah.
Mort Saul is a godfather in a lot of ways. He, if you enjoy any of the, touchstones we've brought up in this little conversation, I think it's fair to say that you owe a little to Mort, and I think you would actually enjoy him too. It's like talking to the smartest guy you know, and he is going to go way faster than you. So you just kind of get to, hop on the train and zoom past all these, don't get hung up on the specifics of his era. Because, of course, anything's going to age poorly when it's out of that week.
Sure.
But I think, excuse me, one second. I think Mort, I apologize. I definitely think Mort is, he gives you so much through the style that he teaches you how to not overthink a joke, really. I think it's easy to overwrite. And the amount of laughs he gets is impressive, considering that he really is winging this. And I do believe if they're doing two shows that night, as each record kind of stay around for the 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
These things are different. Every show is kind of like a little snowflake. So we've been gifted the privilege to listen to, what is it? We've been given the privilege to listen to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 records from the 1960s, and then one more from 73. This is like a touchstone for a lot of comedians you respect, and as a purveyor of comedy, he gets me in the end. I listened to this five of them in a row, and by the end of it, I was getting things I wasn't getting. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a rhythm thing, but you're pulling out laughs that you didn't believe you understood, and you understand it probably better than you think you do. Mm-hmm. This is like a history book come to life.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
I don't know if that's a good enough sales pitch for Mort. Shouldn't be the only person pitching for him. But...
I know. Isn't it odd after 6 years that this is the first time? It's very strange to me.
Yeah. So, when me and Jason started talking, I gave him a list of things, but the number one had to be Mort, because there's so much respect there. And I was moved by how much my friends liked him when they heard him.
Yeah.
Not being awesome. Comedy snobs. I think he connects more than people would think for a 60-year-old record.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
I do not know when this is going to come out, so I apologize. Sure. But where can people find you? What do you have to promote that might be in the distant-ish future?
Sure. Well, I'll just promote some evergreen stuff if that's okay. I have a couple of podcasts on iTunes. I would love some some subscribers and star ratings, because I've put the entire catalog of Hail Satire with Vic Shetty on iTunes. On that program, I've talked to Bo Burnham, Rachel Bloom, Alana Glazer, Nick Offerman, and then like other, Mahershala Ali, who just won the Oscar, and Vanessa Redgrave and Shirley MacLaine.
Wow.
There's a nice mix, mix of writers and comedians and entertainers at large. I've been doing that since 2012, but I just put them all on iTunes because I wanted people to find them a little easier. They've been on YouTube forever. But I would love people to check out Hail Satire. I'm also started this new podcast, as I mentioned a bit. It's called The Daily Show Weekly. I'm doing it with my buddy Chandler Dean, who right now is working on Samantha Bee's show.
Oh, wow.
I think he's still in college, so he's a young man. But he's working there, and he gets to sit on the writer room. We're doing the Herculean feat, Jason, of we are going every single episode of Jon Stewart's Daily Show in order. So we have done 11 episodes at the current. We do one every week. We do 2 weeks every week, basically. So we'll finish this in 9 years or something like that.
Jesus Christ.
We will see. It's so much fun, though, because we're seeing the birth of all your favorites already in the first 14 weeks we've done. We've seen the first episodes of Stephen Colbert and Steve Carell and Nancy Walls and David Tell and Mo Rocca, Beth Littleford. And of course, Jon Stewart is behind the desk for every episode. We're not wasting time with Kilbourne. For me, I think it's the chronicling of America's great mid, 21st century comic. I think Jon Stewart, for me, is the flag I'd place as far as good comedy and important comedy and hilarious comedy.
Yeah.
So check that out on iTunes and YouTube as well. Any subscribes would be wonderful. If you're ever in the Houston area, I do improv at a couple of places. Comedy Sports Houston is some family-friendly short-form improv. I also work at a couple of other theaters around town. And I write articles about comedians for the Houston Press. Talk to a lot of funny people there, Bill Maher and Dick Gregory and a couple others. And Jason, I would love to have you on my podcast at some point.
That'd be a ton of fun.
We'll talk comedy theory and your personal history, because I certainly monopolize this two-way street here.
Well, and, it is a one-and-a-half-way street at the very least, because I can talk about myself for way too long.
Well, we'll make that happen. Come on, Hail Satire, and we'll cross-pollinate like the good bees.
This has been
so much fun. Thank you so much.
This has been a ton of fun. Seriously, you need to come back, and if you're ever in L.A., please come and just do this in the studio.
Sure. I'm hoping to make the move, my friend.
Okay, good.
I'm visiting a couple weeks to look at some apartments, and I'm hoping to be there late summertime. That's my thought.
Holy shit. Yep. Well, that'll be perfect. I don't know what the hell I'll be doing by this time anyway, but comedy album a day. I'm listening to a comedy album a day.
That's great.
By the time this comes out, maybe I'll be caught up. if you go to youtube.com/comedyonvinyl, subscribe there. You guys can also check out my movie that has not been cut into a movie yet, but you can see every video that will make up the bulk of the movie at lookingforwardmovie.com. It was released as a series of blogs last year, all the way from March through November. It all took place during the election process, and then was a very cathartic and depressing end to it. And it's going to be cut into a movie. So maybe by the time this is out, it's almost a movie. We shall see. And also, guys can go to bit.ly/SoapTownDVD to watch to buy the DVD of my first documentary film. It's a real documentary, not a mockumentary like this other thing. I have a confusing career. That's about it. Again, Vic, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Jason. It was a pleasure.
Thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.